this morning to hear me talk about talking. I'll try and operate the prezi. Talking, everything. This isn't something I've done a lot of, so do forgive me if I get lost or a bit nervous. Also, I planned to prepare it all yesterday morning, and my three-year-old refused to go to nursery, so instead I was out playing in the garden. So I think I got it done in the afternoon when he was at Grand's. Right. So, this is sort of the structure of the talk today. I'm going to hopefully explain to you why we should encourage children to talk more. I'm assuming that the fact that you've chosen to come here means that you're fairly well convinced already. When I told my mum what I was doing my work on at school, because this part of my MED, she sort of was shocked and said, surely you all want the children to talk less. She's not a teacher, so hopefully nowadays most teachers do see the value in getting children to talk. I'm going to look at the two main parts of my MED, of the inquiry that we did, which were providing more opportunities for expanding discourse in the classroom and supporting and expanding discourse through our own language use. So first, just a little bit about me. I trained in Scotland, in Murray House. I taught in mainstream primary schools for 8 years, and recently I've been teaching in a provision for children with speech, language and communication difficulties, and I've been there unbelievably now for 6 years, and that's in Mayfield Primary in Midlothian. So we have 10 children in our provision each year. It's an early years provision, so they tend to be primary ones, and the aim is always to return them to mainstream as soon as they're able to cope with that. So occasionally we have them stay on for a year or two. I've also just completed my MED, hopefully. Still waiting for my feedback, but I did hand in slightly late. I've done that through Stirling. I see that Morag Redford's decided to join me today just to find out what I've been doing in the end of my MED. I started off with Morag in the first 2 years. The MED at Stirling is all about inquiry into education, and the idea is that within your own practice and your own context, you sort of follow that in whichever way you want and you develop your interests and the things that you'd like to inquire into. So I gradually came to focus more and more on talking and listening, which is kind of natural since I'm in the SLC provision, but I looked at various aspects of literacy and language before coming to focus on this in my final inquiry. The inquiry, you initially do an individual inquiry and then you go on to a collaborative inquiry. So I was working with the other teachers within our provision and also with the primary one teachers. So it was with the whole of the mainstream classes as well. It wasn't just with those 10 children, because I know that some things are a lot easier with 10 children than with the whole class. So what about you? Again, can I have a quick straw poll, like Ross McGill did? Who's working with, anyone working in nursery? Yeah. Infants? Upper primary? Secondary? Special education? Quite a mixture. I did this talk at the Learning Festival at Preston Lodge, and it was mainly secondary teachers, and so I had to adapt it a bit and not talk too much about washing babies and handling stick insets and things. I knew that wouldn't go down too well with it. So why should we encourage children to talk more? Through the CPE process, initially I had to justify why I was doing what I was and provide the rationale for it, and that was based on literature, theory, and all the books we could get out of Stirling Library. And I became very good friends with this man. Any takers? Anyone know who this is?
Vygotsky.
Thank you, Vygotsky. I've become a bit of a fan. I went on a Vygotsky, and of course there's Lady Bernard called Galina Dolya. He's from Russia and has a wonderful accent and works in the Vygotsky Institute, and I was really enraptured by her. I think she thought it was a bit crazy. But really, a lot of Vygotsky's work sort of encapsulates what I came to look at, and it was actually really nice through the literature search to keep finding all these links back and seeing all the connections. So Vygotsky was a psychologist who came up with social constructivism. He was the one who really introduced the idea of how important language is for developing our thoughts and how the two are so interrelated. So there's a few quotes from him that you can read. Um, Vygotsky was writing in Russia in the 1920s, but it took until the sort of 60s and 70s before his work was translated into English, and that's why a lot of the quotes are from later. There was Douglas Barnes was working in the UK in the 60s and 70s, and he translated a lot of his work and looked into it in more depth. And it was actually Douglas Barnes that came up with the phrase of scaffolding. We think of it as one of Vygotsky's main theories, but Barnes built on that to come up with the idea of scaffolding to develop children's learning. So what I found out in my reading on all the theories of Vygotsky really gave me the confidence to say there is a real value in getting children to talk more, and a real need to do it. And it was quite in contrast to what I was seeing in our school. There was a lot of children, even coming to primary one, going straight to sitting on their desk, listening to the teacher, doing a lot of writing. And I'm sure we're not the only school that's still working in that way. So talking has performs two main things. There's talking for the sake of developing language, talking to learn to talk. We work a lot in my provision with ICANN, who are a children's communication charity, and they've done a lot of reports and studies into the state of children's talking in the UK at the moment, and unfortunately it is something that's becoming more and more of an issue. I think the current estimates are that about 50% of children enter school with some sort of language delay, and in areas of deprivation that can be up to 80%. So you're looking at the majority of the class having some sort of issue with language. It might be pronunciation issues, or more often it's slightly more hidden sort of problems with understanding the rules of communication, the purposes of communication, or simply being very reluctant talkers. And that was one of the first things that came out when I spoke to my CPE group, was that every year there was a handful of children who just didn't want to say a word, and how to get them to open up and get them to access the language. A lot of the studies actually show that that's not always the case at home. We sometimes think, well, maybe they didn't get the input at home, the parents don't talk to them, that's the problem. And there are problems around children using more and more video games, watching more and more TV. But actually, a lot of the studies that I came across show that children's language at home can be far greater than they use in school. So that made me start thinking, well, how do we change what we're offering them in the classroom? So talking can be, picture of all the people chatting, that's just to emphasise how important talking is as a social skill. We're all doing it today, we all do it when we go out with our friends, and it's the same for children. If they don't talk, they don't develop those social relationships, and that can lead to problems with their confidence, their self-esteem, all sorts of things as they progress through school. And then at the bottom, something I came across again in a lot of the readings was how much talking is needed to develop the written skills, and if we rush too much into trying to teach children to read and write, it can really have a detrimental effect, because speaking and listening have to come first. If children haven't mastered those skills, they're always going to struggle with reading and writing, because they're the matching skills to those. So one of the things I've been doing in my school is really pushing them to slow down and to not worry if the children aren't reading and writing by the end of primary one. As long as they're talking and listening really well, then the other skills will come on a lot quicker. And finally, of course, we had to refer to the policy and to treatment for excellence. If you look in your E's and O's, you can struggle to find a lot about talking. It's still quite hidden in there. But in the background to Creative for Excellence, it really was a big thing. This is the four capacities. And at some point in my NL, I said it was good to do a little word count, and I counted up the different words that were appearing. And the word communication is the second most common word in the four capacities. And it was also a big part of the principles and practice document, where they said that we should be in somewhere. We should be having frequent opportunities. Our children should have frequent opportunities to communicate through collaborative work, collaborative play, and discussion. None of these things come up in the E's and O's, unfortunately. and talking and listening are still grouped together, whereas reading and writing have their own separate needs and roles. So I think it's quite a shame that it hasn't really been pushed through in the same way it was in England, I think, called the National Oracy Project, and they really upped the importance of talking and listening. It hasn't quite come through in the nitty-gritty of cricket for excellence. But I think there's enough there to provide some justification for saying, no, we are waiting, we're going to do more reading next year. We're not worried if they can't write, we do it as a group, and we'll talk about it, and they'll verbally come up with the sentences, and that's exactly how we work within our provision, because we have to. It's all done verbally, and the teachers will write it, and then eventually the children do get there, and they get there a lot quicker because they understand, they know what a sentence is, they know what parts are involved, and they know how to tell a story because they've done it all verbally. So, the first thing we decided in school was that if we wanted children to talk more, we had to provide an environment that gave them that chance to. We couldn't continue to ask them questions and get them to sit on the carpet and listen and send them off to their tables to work and suddenly expect them to talk more, no matter what we did with our language. So we started by looking at what sort of things could we introduce to give them those opportunities to talk more. And we realised that certainly our primary one classrooms were too formal, and we weren't giving them a chance to engage in extended discourse. One of the writers that I came across was a man called David Dickinson, not the one with the bad tan and the antiques. He's a professor in America, Harvard, I think. And he came up with a lot of suggestions for what he called a communicative environment and making a classroom a communicative environment. There was a lot of studies over in America into what was actually being said in classrooms, and they came up with this idea of the IRE pattern, which is initiation, response and evaluation, and they found that most conversations in class followed that pattern. So the teacher would say, what colour's the grass? It's green. Yes. And that was all you got, and they found that that really encouraged children to give very short answers, to not say anything beyond what the teacher was wanting. And for a lot of children, they're not telling the grass is green because they know it is. They're telling the grass is green because they think that's what they're meant to say. And you often see the panic in them. What's she asking me? What does she want me to say? And we have to get beyond that. And we have to say to children, I just want to listen to you. I want your ideas. It's not just about me getting you to say the right answers. So what we found coming up again and again in the literature was that play-based learning was the way to go. Seen that children do talk a lot more at home, and what do? More at home they play, and when they play they naturally talk. And my little 3-year-old, as I said, from the last couple of years, he's been playing trains, mad on his trains, and he'll talk the whole time, quite elaborate stories. And Vygotsky said that external monologue is the way children develop their understanding, and it's the same as adults. We think it in our head, we've learned not to have to do it externally, but young children need to externally verbalise it to get their thoughts straight and to come up with these ideas. So there's one more Vygotsky quote here. And this was another benefit of play. Not only does it encourage them to talk, but it's a natural environment for them. They think they're, hopefully they are, but they certainly think they're having fun. They think, oh, we're just playing. And I've had one of the proudest comments I've heard from a child is, Mrs. Kelly didn't make us do any work today. Just play. Yes. If that's what you think, then we're doing something right. Because when they're playing, that's when they're really thinking, and that's when they start really coming up with much more complex language. So what we did in our inquiry over the 10 weeks was introduced a half-hour session each week with each class, and we called it talking time. And within that session, we would have different play-based activities running. At the start of the session, the children could choose which one they wanted to go to. And the teachers found that in itself was a real skill for the children to have to look and think about it and select which one they wanted. And if that group was full, they had to pick another. And they actually got much better at that, which we found was a really useful skill. We tried to use a lot of the ideas that we'd come up with in our literature. And again, as I said, David Dickinson gave a lot of great ideas. If you Google them, you'll come up with a few of his pieces. And there's a really useful chapter on the internet that came from a recent book that he contributed to that I found very interesting. one of the groups that we ran we called Small World, and at various times we had train sets, we had emergency vehicles. We always tried to link it in with the topic that the children were doing so that they had that wider knowledge going on. And we found that this was really good for, the boys really liked it of course, the girls would join in too, and it was really good for sort of getting them to work together. There was the problem solving of building the train track, and then they would gradually, quite often begin to play alone, but gradually start to interact with each other, and also with the adults. One of the main things in this approach was that there was always an adult at each activity, and they were joining in as a play partner. They weren't just observing, they weren't telling each other what to do, they were just playing trains as well. We found a real sort of access to the children through that you could go in and say, oh, my train's crashed, oh no, and someone would always come over, oh, I've got the train, I'll help you out, and just begin to develop a story through that. The next group we had, was the role play table. We had initially a baby washing sort of area, with baby baths and soap and bottles and potties and clothes and towels and all sorts. We really loved that. And then we had a station because they were talking about the new railway that was being built. So we had a railway station and trains and a ticket office and everything. One of the things we really found at role play was that if you could connect to something the children had going on in their lives outside, then you really got a lot of language going on. So a lot of children went to the baby area and then would start talking about their baby siblings or their mum being pregnant, and that really got a lot of language out of them. And it really helped us get to know them as well, especially with our new primary ones coming in. We found that we got to know them much quicker and in much more depth. They would open up about their life outside school, which was really useful as well. So this is the one that's meant to say Wonder Table. So this was the idea that children will talk if they've seen something that excites them, if they've seen something that they're interested in. And we were trying to develop what Douglas Barnes called exploratory talk in this. So it's all about, I wonder what this is. I wonder how he moves. I wonder why he's not moving. I wonder what he eats. I wonder if he goes to the toilet. So all those things would come up. And again, we were there as the adults, not asking these questions and not answering these questions, but wondering alongside them. And we did find, as the literature suggested, that whereas if we'd said to them, what does he eat, and half of them would say, I don't know, and half of them would have come up with all sorts of crazy answers, if we just said, oh gosh, I wonder if he's eating that plant, and they'd say, oh yes, because I can see that's his mouth, and I think he's eating the plant, and oh no, I don't think that's his mouth, I think that's his bottom. You would just get a lot more sort of free speech from the children. They didn't feel like they were being assessed, they didn't feel under pressure to know the answers. They were just wandering alongside you. So they had our stick insects. We also had snails, which they really loved, and they got them out and got them crawling up their hands and things, and they had to clean them out. So they really enjoyed that, and it's quite simple. They don't need a lot. They don't need anything particularly fancy, just something a little bit exciting for them. So I think mini beasts works pretty well with children. You could also have a vase of flowers, or you could take them outside. Anything that you're just looking at in a bit more detail, looking at ordinary wood. And this one was my particular favourite. This was a lady called Fleur Griffith, who I came across. I came across it in a random paper I found on the internet. And then I bought a book, The Articulate Classroom, and it had a chapter from her. And then I bought another book, and it was written by Fleur Griffiths. So I thought, oh, she's gone places in the world since this random paper from 20 years ago. She was a nursery teacher, and I think is now head of a teaching college in England. And one of the things that she'd come up with was called the Talking Table. So the way we ran it was a great big piece of paper that covers the whole table. And that had a lot of benefits, and it made them feel much more like they were part of a group. One of the classroom assistants said it's great because they can never say I'm finished because there's so much space, and they really did interact with each other. So we had one day a boy had drawn his house, and the boy beside him was drawing a football pitch, and by the end of it there was all these lines because he was kicking the football and it was smashing all his windows. and knocking his mum over. And the two of them, as they drew, were talking about this whole story, so it really becomes part of the narrative. The idea of them colouring it in is, again, it makes it more playful. It gives them something concrete, and it takes the pressure off. It's not that I've been asked to sit here and talk about something. It's, oh, I've just drawn a picture. And again, we were there modelling it as the adults. We were drawing our own pictures and talking about, oh, I enjoy the beach. I went to the beach with my children and I had a picnic. And we would start looking, and then quite often they would pick up, like, oh, I went for a picnic and I'm drawing my teddy bears. And you would get so much talking out of that. It's a lovely thing to do maybe on a Monday morning, rather than, right, we're going to sit and write about our weekend, or try to spend ages hearing every single child talk about their weekend. The whole class can be writing, or they can be going off with the learning assistant groups, drawing their pictures, and they will just start to talk away. And that was one they really enjoyed by the end of it. They were all, that was the first choice, and, oh, I wanted to come to the talking table today. I think in the initial paper I read from Fleur Griffith, she asked them to bring an item in from home, and she said to make it really simple and not have enormous structures come in. It had to be something you could fit in the palm of your hand. And she said it was fabulous. They would come in with shells, they would come in with bouncy balls, they'd come in with a tooth that had fallen out, and that was the basis for their drawing. What she found and what we found ourselves was that even the really quiet children would come, and they might come in the first week, they don't say a word, and you might go up and sit beside them and they might say, that's all you get. But by the third or the fourth week, they're realising that actually it's okay, I can just talk here and there's no right or wrong and I can talk about whatever I want, and they begin to come up with a lot more. So, just so that I'm not doing all the talking in this talk about getting other people to talk, I wonder if any of you have tried similar things like this, activities in your classroom that provide children with a chance to talk more. So.
We have at our school, the primary school, we've got big start times in spring and year. So instead of coming in and sitting down and listening, they have activities that have been selected either by small groups of children or by the teacher if there's a specific purpose. They come in and they engage in these activities, and obviously they're talking about what they did before they came into school. It's just an environment that's play-based and encourages talking, and I have to say it's a great success right from primary 1 to primary 7.
What sort of things would they be doing in primary 7 during that time?
Well, the teacher's very clever. He's got things like pictures on the smart board with, what's the word for them? Different pictures that you have to link together to create a word.
Right.
So some of them would be involved in that. They would be equally just tabletop activities that could link to previous learning, or something that the kids said, hey, we'd like to do this, could be instruction as well.
On the other end of the scale, I teach in secondary, and we've given that our second years the task of researching, are you going to talk on somebody who was the hero? And one little so-and-so had said, we always have to do it on boring people, old people. You know, and I said, well, okay, who would you like to talk about? And she introduced me to the work of Alfie Days and Zoe Suggs, the Zoella. And these guys are video bloggers, and they do things called Draw Your Life. So they draw, and they talk through. And this is on YouTube. But I discovered that my young faculty head has been doing this with her higher texts, draw the key points of Sunset Song and talk it through. And she reckons it's a better way to get them to internalise the key points of the narrative in a way that writing the notes or reading everything there is to read about Sunset Song. I can actually see the same patterns from your little ones, right the way up to university students doing this.
There's one thing we've started doing in the writing. I think very often we teach writing, you say, right, you're allowed to draw a picture once you've finished your writing. We've turned it around and said, okay, you can start with your picture, because that's then giving them the chance to think it through, gives you a chance to wander around and talk about it, so that when they come to the writing, they've already prepared it verbally, they've got all their ideas, then they can focus on the actual task of writing it down.
I work in a language unit, which sounds very similar to the one that you work in, and we find that a lot of our children don't have any language currently, so we use the kind of Hannon-based approach where we narrate what they're doing alongside them to try and give them an example, but we try and do it in a way that just seems like we're chatting and take the pressure off a bit. It can take a long time before any language comes back from the child.
Yeah.
And I think you have to be patient and know that, well, that's okay. Mm-hmm. We might do this for quite a number of weeks before we see the return on it, but it would be
very much. We take photographs of the nursery children when they're out to teach in Forest Kindergarten or out on library walks or environmental walks, and use the instructional tools on the smartboards so that the children have the tool to recall that experience, and it gives them first-hand, they've had the first-hand experience, but that being it allows them to revisit that and they're more able then to talk the experience through.
Connecting this up with outdoor learning is really useful because again they've got the things that they want to talk about. And also playground games, we tried it out 1 week, unfortunately because of weather and various things we couldn't use it very much, but just the idea of taking them out into the playground and saying, well, you tell me what game you want to play. I don't know that, what's the rules? And again, you're giving them the position of being the one in the know, and they're teaching you, and it's all their own language, and it's something they're interested in. So, so of course, being part of my MEd, I had to gather the evidence and record what difference this was making. Thankfully, at the end, the evidence did show that their talking had improved. So we recorded how much they were talking in each activity each week. We'd also asked the class teachers to fill in an assessment of how much they were talking in class as well before we started. And what we found was that in the first few weeks, 42% of children were talking more. And when we looked into this in detail to see where they'd been at the start, it was the children who were already quite confident talkers who showed the most increase. 56% of children who were already quite chatty in class increased the amount they were talking in our groups, compared to 35% of reluctant talkers. So that brings me on to the next part of the project, which was changing the way we spoke to the children. And this was, in a way, this was the bit that I was really interested in. We introduced the play-based activities so that we could get at this. So we were looking at supporting and expanding the children's talking through our own languages. So going back to the 1970s, the sort of research that was going on, as I said, and finding that schools were still very much stuck in that teacher at the front, children sitting listening sort of pattern. Joan Tuff, who's also a professor over in Harvard, did a lot of research on the way that teachers use their language, and she was the first to sort of suggest that the way a teacher chooses to speak to children can really inhibit them from speaking, or it can really encourage them to speak, which is probably something that all of you have noticed at least some point in your careers. This also really tied in with all the information I was getting from the speech and language therapists, and that's one of the real privileges of working in the speech and language provision, is that you work very closely with speech and language therapists, and you realise they're not just there to teach people how to pronounce the sound, they're there to really help develop conversation and understanding and listening and all these different things. And they've said all along in all their documentation, don't ask children questions. They don't like it. It puts them under pressure, it shuts them down. If you get a response, it'll be a one-word response. So it's much better to develop your dialogue by making comments, by trying to be an equal partner in conversations. I really like this. This is just a picture I found on the internet. But I really liked it because I think you can see in that teacher's face, she's genuinely interested. And if you're going to be a conversation partner, you've got to listen as well. So I think as teachers, we need to learn to really be interested, not just asking a question for the sake of recapping the last lesson or finding, testing their knowledge, making sure they're listening, all the different reasons that we do ask questions. Also, we need to ask questions because we're really interested. And if we think of trying to avoid questions unless they're needed, it brings us to what's called authentic questions, which is, I actually need to find out a piece of information from you. And that's the only sort of question we would ask each other. We don't come in and start testing each other on our knowledge of history or whatever. We ask questions, how are you? How's your dad was ill? How's he getting on? We're asking about things that we don't know the answer to. And then we've got to listen and genuinely show that we're interested. And it's the same with children. The more they know that someone's interested in what they have to say, the more likely they are to start talking and opening up to us. We see again, she's got down to their level. She's making eye contact, which is very important. She's very relaxed and friendly. And I imagine she's getting quite good talk from those children. And that's something that the play-based learning allows you to do very well, as long as you're willing to get really involved in it.
Again, this links back to the studies that show that children speak more at home. And they find not only do they speak more at home, but they use more complex language. They ask more questions. I think it's something like children at home ask 95% of the questions. Believe me, I've got a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. I'm sure that's right. In class, they ask 5% of questions. And that's quite a shocking difference. We know that children have got the language to ask those questions. They have that interest and want to ask those questions. And they come into classroom and all that shuts down. So avoiding questions was something that we really tried. What we did was, after running our sessions for about 4 or 5 weeks, we met together, we talked about all the different ideas for changing our language, and then we continued the sessions, but we really focused on our language, and we tried to not ask questions, we tried to make comments. If we did ask questions, it was something authentic. Which again is the benefit of getting them talking about their home life. If they're talking about their home life, their family, their pets, then you can genuinely say, oh, what's your job called? And how many pets do you have? And what did you do at the weekend? Because you don't know the answers. And again, that's empowering them. That's showing them that that's information that they have that you're asking for. So we continued our sessions. And trying to use Coldplay. So I've just got a few quotes written down here. Rod Corridon, who I came across quite a few times, he said that Coldplay is effective because it allows teachers to engage with children as equals, which sort of gets rid of that imbalance in the IRE questions. So not only are you giving them a chance to talk more, but you're saying to them, you know, we're just equals. I'm not the one, I'm not here to boss you around. I'm here to talk with you and play with you equally. And then David Wood, who came up quite a lot, he did a study into the way children actually talk when you ask them questions or when you make comments with them. And he found that children, practitioners who forego questions and use comments or personal contributions, receive the widest range, the longest and the most animated responses from pupils. And again, that's what we found when we really focused in on doing that in our sessions. And this tiger's here because someone passed on to me a document from Worcestershire speech and language therapists. Again, you can find it on the internet if you search Worcestershire Primary PHT, Primary Healthcare Trust, from 2010. It's a really nice document. It's got lots of pages of tips for talking and ways to expand talk. So it's quite useful. I'll tweet it. Try. I'm a very technophobic tweeter, but I'm trying. So one of the pages, they had a picture of the tiger, and this was really to illustrate the idea of being a conversation partner and not asking questions. So it suggested that you could come in and say, what is this? What is he doing? What colour is he? You wouldn't get much of a response. You might get tiger, hiding, stripy. Or you could come in, using the comments and using that idea of a personal interest, and say, oh, goodness, he looks fierce. And hopefully you get at least one child who will say, yeah. Oh, I think you might want to eat us. And you get another child who might say, oh, I think I'm going to run away. Okay, that's a good idea. What should we do then? We could hide. And again, it develops the narrative, draws them in. And it says to them, I'm not here to test your knowledge. I'm here to get you to talk. We're going to have fun. And we're going to develop a story together. So when I think of the tiger now, it always makes me think of that idea of moving away from being the questioning person to being the conversation partner. Again, we collected our evidence on this, and were we having more impact now that we changed our speech? Thankfully, again, we did. And what was really pleasing for me was that we were starting to have an impact on those reluctant talkers. We found that by week 8 of our project, 81% of children were talking more than they had been at the start. Obviously, you'd expect this about 2-3 months on, you'd expect them to be settling into primary school and talking a bit more. But when we looked at the difference between the chatty children and the quiet children from the start, we found that the reluctant speakers who really had increased their talk, 70% of them, these were children who were judged at the start of, before we started, to be seldom talking in class or never talking in class. 70% of them were talking frequently by week 7, at least during these sessions. And we did see an overspill into their general classroom activities as well. And that's compared to only 16% who were already very chatty because they were just continuing to join. So we did find that even very quiet children could be encouraged to talk through a few simple changes. And I'm just going to leave you to back up that evidence with this last slide. Hope it's big enough for you to see. This was an assessment that I did alongside all the teacher observations. I took a sample group of children out and showed them pictures, 10 pictures each, and just I tried to encourage them to talk. Obviously, I had to ask them a few questions and ask a few put in a few comments to get them to go along. But I tried not to do it too much so we could see what their natural input was. And this was just showing you before and after for one lovely little boy, Brian, who was very quiet at the start. So this was picture 6, and you can see he said, they're having a swim. Not sure if it's a swimming pool or the sea. And I said, yeah, you can't tell because you can't see the edges. And I did pause and wait to see if he would say any more, but he didn't. To move on. And then underneath, I'm not going to read it all out, but you can see what a difference. He was really thinking it through, lots of that exploratory language coming up, making links to his own life. And then I was able to ask him, I said, have you learned to swim? So I was able to ask him authentic questions. And it was much more like a natural conversation between two people. And I saw that a lot in this sample group. It changed from me dragging information out of them to them just, oh, we're going to sit down and talk about some pictures. And that was really nice to see. I'll just leave that up. About 10 minutes if anyone wants to add anything or ask any questions.
Did you say that it was half an hour a day?
We did half an hour a week.
A week?
Yeah, we initially tried to do half an hour twice a week, but the way we ran it, we had 5 activities going on at a time, so it meant you needed 5 adults. So we had the class teacher, the learning system, and 3 members of staff from the speech and language provision. Things that happen in schools, it was always
that was enough to make it.
That was enough to make it work. But the class teachers have been keen to continue it, so they're doing things like you were suggesting, where everyone just comes in, and some of them might be just playing by themselves, and the teachers will move around, or sending little groups off with a learning assistant that can sort of help them bring this time together. Certainly, the talking time they're finding now that the children are out of the way of it, they know how to do it. They can all sit down and all be drawing, and the teacher can move around and target certain people. So there is ways of making it work without that number of staff.
How many children per group?
We limited it to 5.
So 25 children.
Yeah. Which is probably about the maximum you would need. It gets too big to sort of lose that. You lose the ability as the adult to involve all the children. But I mean, we did find sometimes we had, so one time I was working with 5 boys, quite rowdy boys from our group, with the emergency vehicles, and they were just having a ball, but there was no talking going on, there was siren noises, there was crash and bang. I thought, right, what do we need to do? Trying to remember all this stuff, and going, right, I've got to join in, we've got to make a story out of it, because the temptation is to go, come back here and sit down and stop running about and don't hit him with the fire engine. No, let's just try it, the way we've been reading about it. So I got a little, some sort of house. So I've got a man going on top of the house. I said, help, help, the hotel's on fire. Every single boy came running from whichever corner of the room they were in. Oh, I've got the fire engine, get the ladders out, we need the hoses. And I was just like, oh, wow, this works. So that was a really nice moment. There was quite a few really nice moments like that where you just thought, this works. And also it's great fun. I read somewhere that there's some horrific statistic of the number of teachers who don't like play-based learning and don't want to get involved in it. I just think, bring it on, it's so much fun. And the children enjoy it so much and they learn so much from it. So hopefully if you've not done it before, you go home and try a bit in your schools. Or even if you're not into the play-based learning, or if you're working with secondary and you think we're not going to be running about with cars, think about ways you can change your approach to teaching just through the way you talk, and think, how can I ask less questions? How can I make comments? And using things like the pictures on the whiteboard. I saw Hal Roberts speaking at a conference last year, and he uses
he calls them hooks. Every lesson has to have a hook to get the children's attention. So he says very often I have a big picture on the smart board when they come in, and they'll all come in and go, what's that? What's he doing? And you've got their interest, and then you've got something you can talk about and can wonder about together. And you can put them in that position rather than right now I'm going to ask you questions to see how much you have.
Can I check what the other activity tables you had? A talking table, small world, role play, and a wonder table.
A talking table, small world, role play, table. We ran a group looking at PLPs, personal learning plans. This was the work of a lady called Margaret Carr, who did a lot of work about talking about previous learning and found that really benefited the children. Really working on their supervision, and look, you couldn't do this before and now you can, and look at this great work, works on their mindsets and evidence. So we thought that might be a really good group, and the class teachers had been tasked with setting up PLPs for all the children anyway, so we thought, well, we can get the PLPs out, add their new work, look back over it. Unfortunately, because it was right at the start of the year, there wasn't a lot in it, and the children, it just didn't really work, so we ended up having another role play group. But it might be an idea that could work maybe further up the school when they've already got some evidence in a folder that they could come and sit and say, oh, look, do you remember last year when we did this? And you as the class teacher, and you say, oh, that was with your old teacher. Let me see. I could see it working with older children, but it wasn't very successful in that way, so that's why I didn't include it.
The work built for the nursery transition into primary one PLPs.
Yes. I think that's what we hoped, that we could use the things from coming up from nursery, but apparently there was a change and those all get sent home. We didn't have them in school.
We keep them in school for the first 6 weeks, then we'll go
back
to that.
Things I did when after primary one class was I take photographs of the activities the week before, and then that's how we then kept the PLP to up and go, because the week we would then be talking about the previous learning. And that kind of got it all started and came to do it regularly.
Okay, I'll let you go.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
When I do tweet, it's @AileenDunbar.